Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories, number 30, for mid-March 2024. Grace Nottage Nicholas, Black is Beautiful. Welcome to the 30th episode of Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories, an historic and active cemetery in Bala Cynwyd, Pennsylvania. I am Dr. Joe Lex, retired professor of emergency medicine from Temple University, volunteer tour guide, and volunteer podcaster. Laurel Hill West opened in 1869 across the river from its sister cemetery, Laurel Hill East in Philadelphia. It is more than twice as big as Laurel Hill East. It has a totally different feel and a strikingly different population. And like Laurel Hill East, it is open 365 days a year, now from 7 a.m. to 7 p.m. There is plenty of parking at the business office just off Belmont Avenue or at the conservatory and the bell tower. If you enter from Belmont, follow the road past the second gate that has a white line in the middle. It'll take you right to the bell tower. Another possibility, just come in while you're walking the Cynwyd Trail. Your best bet for public transportation, take the R6 to Manayunk or a bus to the Wissahickon Transportation Center on Ridge Avenue, then cross the Schuylkill River. You will be leaving Philadelphia, coming into Lower Merion, and after you cross the river on the Pencoyd Pedestrian Bridge, you will walk up Writer's Ferry Road to the entrance across from the Pet Cemetery. The 30th episode of Biographical Bites from Bala is for mid-March of 2024, Women's History Month. Grace Nottage Nicholas was an older sister of civil rights activist C. Dolores Tucker, but Grace made a name for herself as a teacher, a parole officer, a police detective, and a beauty queen at a time when women of color were not welcome to traditional beauty pageants. Listen as I tell you the evolution of beauty pageants, how pigmentocracy and straight hair define beauty from a white perspective, how African American women created their own standards of beauty and started their own beauty pageants, and much more on this Women's History Month broadcast of Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories. Once upon a time, the gods and goddesses of Mount Olympus were having a party in honor of nothing special. But they forgot to invite the goddess of discord, Eris, who was insulted, and she planned revenge. She created her own special event to compete with the rest of the gods, a beauty contest. She offered as a prize the infamous Apple of Discord, which was inscribed to the most beautiful. Beauty was no longer uncontested. Instead of being beautiful or not being beautiful, there was now a hierarchy. Most beautiful, second most beautiful, third most beautiful, and so on down the line to the ugliest. Well, after a preliminary elimination, three goddesses were chosen for the finals: Athena, Hera, and Aphrodite. The gods were no fools. They chose a mere man named Paris of Troy to serve as judge. Paris thus became the first in a long line of men who judged the worth of women by their looks. The goddesses were indeed beautiful, but they were vain and petty things who went all out to be chosen number one. They all offered Paris bribes. Hera offered to make him king of Europe and Asia. Athena offered wisdom and skill in war. But Paris chose Aphrodite, who bribed him with the most beautiful mortal woman in the world, Helen of Sparta, wife of Menelaus. And when Paris carried Helen off to Troy, the Greeks invaded Troy for her return, and thus began the Trojan War, all because of a beauty contest. The first beauty contest in the United States was probably part of a traveling circus show, although I have seen both Phineas T. Barnum and his competitor, Adam Forepaugh, who's interred at Laurel Hill East. I've seen both of them named as the instigator. It may have served as a stimulation to add a girly show, a burlesque show, to the sideshow. The first mention of an American beauty contest comes from folklore. Many historians place it at Rehoboth Beach, Delaware, in 1880, organized by local businessman Joseph H. Dodge, who was trying to attract visitors to his resort. He offered a monetary prize. According to one historian, quote, "This was perhaps the first time that a not too talented, not too intelligent or industrious girl of Victorian prudence could make honest money solely on her looks," end quote. Dodge set the criteria for contestants. They had to be no more than 25 years old, a minimum of 5'4" tall, and a maximum of 130 pounds. Young, unmarried, tall, and skinny. In addition to cash, there was another prize for the winner of this contest, a bridal trousseau. The grandmother of all American beauty contests was started in 1920 by H. Conrad Ekholm, the proprietor of the Monticello Hotel in Atlantic City, New Jersey. He, too, was trying to attract tourists to his hotel by extending summer past the Labor Day weekend for a contest the next weekend. And this first event was so successful that the Businessman's League planned to repeat it the following year as a beauty pageant or a bather's review. And thus, newspapers from Pittsburgh to Washington, D.C. were asked to sponsor local beauty contests. The winners would participate in the Atlantic City contest. If the local newspaper would pay for the winner's wardrobe, the Atlantic City Businessman League would pay for the contestants' travel to compete in the Intercity Beauty Contest. A newspaper reporter named Herb Test coined the term for the winner, Miss America. And on 8 September 1921, 100,000 people gathered at the boardwalk to watch the contestants from Washington, D.C., Baltimore, Pittsburgh, Harrisburg, Ocean City, Camden, Newark, New York City, and Philadelphia. And out of the nine contestants, the two frontrunners were Virginia Lee and Margaret Gorman. But the judges disqualified 22-year-old Lee at the last minute because she was deemed as a professional rather than an amateur like the other contestants. They found that she was a working actress and a married woman who was a friend of the competition's chief judge. Thus, a 16-year-old girl from Washington, D.C., Margaret Gorman, was crowned the Golden Mermaid, and she won $100. The first radio broadcast of Miss America was in 1925, only 4 years after its birth. There was, by now, a representative from each of the 48 states. In 1924, Alta Sterling, who competed as Miss Sioux City, Iowa, became the first Jewish contestant to compete for Miss America. In 1941, Mifanwi Shunatona, Miss Oklahoma, became the first Native American contestant. In 1945, Miss New York City, Bess Meyerson, became the first Jewish American to win the Miss America pageant, although she had refused to change her name to Bess Meredith or Beth Merrick, as was requested by the organizers. You know, Meyerson was too Jewish. Despite the crown, Meyerson said, "I couldn't even stay in certain hotels. There'd be signs that said, 'No coloreds, no Jews, no dogs.' I felt so rejected. Here I was, chosen to represent American womanhood, and then America treated me like this." She cut short her Miss America reign. She resigned and instead traveled with the Anti-Defamation League, where she spoke against discrimination in a talk entitled, "You Can't Be Beautiful and Hate." In 1948, Irma Nydia Vasquez, the first Miss Puerto Rico, became the first Latina contestant. Also 1948, Yun Tao Chi, the first Miss Hawaii, was the first Asian American contestant. The pageant was first televised nationally in 1954. Future television star Lee Merriweather was crowned Miss America in 1955. And television viewership peaked during the early 1960s, when the Miss America pageant was the highest rated program on American television. But black women were missing, except for that time in 1923 that a group of black women appeared on stage as slaves during a white girls' talent competition. It was right there in Rule 7. Contestants must be of good health and of the white race. As late as 1940, all contestants were required to list on their formal biological data sheet how far back they could trace their ancestry. It was not until 1971 that Sherrill Brown, Miss Iowa of 1970, became the first African-American contestant in the competition's history during the Miss America 1971 pageant on 12 September 1970, although she lost to future media personality Miss Texas 1970, Phyllis George. The first big successes for black American beauties in integrated competition were won in France. Black beauty contestants, like African American musicians and writers, found France a more hospitable country than the United States. And in 1959, American black woman Cecilia Cooper won Festival at Cannes, an event widely reported in the black press. Now, Cooper was a graduate of a charm and beauty school that had been launched by Ophelia DeVore in New York City. DeVore had opened a modeling agency for black women. Her early models were those like her who were ethnically ambiguous and could pass as white. But DeVore advertised all her women as black, no matter where they fell on the pigment scale. DeVore's school produced such black icons as actress and singer Diane Carroll, stage and film actress Cecily Tyson, Essence magazine editor Susan Taylor, and many others. Essence magazine started in 1970, specifically for African American women. The title of Miss Festival of Cannes was won by another African American the next year, in 1960, Lejeune Hundley. Her victory was celebrated in Ebony magazine as a victory for all black Americans. Now, just because they were not invited to the party did not mean that black women could not have a party of their own. After all, enslaved black women have had a more continuous history of employment than white women in the United States. The catchphrase, "Black is beautiful," was still a few years away, and white America had a lot to learn since the days of founding Father Thomas Jefferson, champion of the rights of man and owner of enslaved humans. He explained the black race's, forgive me, ugliness as the primary reason that freed men should not be permitted to remain in the United States in his Notes on the State of Virginia, with his pro-eugenic thoughts. Quote, The circumstances of superior beauty is thought worthy attention in the propagation of our horses, dogs, and other domestic animals. Why not in that of man? Jefferson concluded by saying that the, quote, colored race is inferior to the whites in the endowment both of body and of mind. Now, compare Jefferson's words to those of black intellectual and political leader W.E.B. Du Bois, who wrote to his daughter in 1904 and tried to brace her for the insults he feared she would encounter while she was at school in England. You will meet curious little annoyances. People will wonder at your dear brown skin and the sweet crinkly hair. You must know that brown is as pretty as white, or prettier, and crinkly hair as straight, even though it is harder to comb. African Americans have been a heterogeneous group for centuries. As a result of a few hundred years of mixing with other ethnicities, African Americans have a wide range of complexions, facial features, eye and hair colors, and hair textures. The ranking of African American women according to their shade of skin, pigmentocracy, has been a frequent theme in African American fiction. The Blacker the Berry, Wallace Thurman's satirical treatment of African American skin color prejudice, was extremely popular and controversial when it was published in 1929. Black ethnic features are not considered beautiful in a Eurocentric population. Dark skin, tightly curled hair, and full lips were not some of the elements of beauty that are judged in white women. Popular caricatures of blacks exaggerated those features that white people found different. In the dominant medium of newspapers, the most common image of the black woman was the domestic servant. She was usually portrayed as a fat, big-lipped, dark-skinned woman who wore a head wrap in a setting that otherwise featured thin, pale white women with flowing hair. This was the mammy character. The other standard black female stereotype was the hypersexual but never quite beautiful enough young woman, the Jezebel. It would be impossible for black women to meet Eurocentric standards. The average black woman could not alter her hair color or her facial features, but she could remove the curl from her hair. And so, almost without exception, a black girl's hair was braided until she was old enough to have it straightened, and then it was straightened over and over for the rest of her life. The most common method used was to dress it with a protective coat of pomade, known colloquially as grease, and then comb it with a metal hot comb that had been heated in the flames of a kitchen stove. Now, the type of grease mattered. Women who used Crisco, the plant-based shortening, shortening is any fat that's solid at room temperature. But if they used Crisco, they might garner a comment like, you smell like fried chicken. Black women realized they needed their own definitions of beauty and their own way of judging it. A separate but unequal world had been developed by African Americans. By 1910, there were 35,000 black churches in the United States. African Americans established 106 colleges, more than 2,000 newspapers before 1950. In the pre-civil rights era, black women remained trapped in the least desirable occupations. In 1930, most black women worked either as farmhands or domestics. As late as 1950, 41% of black working women were employed as household servants, but only 5% of black working women, as compared to 40% of white working women, were clerical or sales workers. So Sunday was their day to shine. Black women donned fabulous hats on Sunday along with a clean, pretty dress and their straightened hair to convey personal and racial pride. Acceptance among others of their own ethnic group was important. tests were developed to check for the right amount of hair straightening and the proper amount of skin pigment. Bouncers at clubs open to blacks would use the comb test to measure the kinkiness of a person's hair. The comb had to pass through a head of hair without stopping before the person could get inside the club. And as far as skin pigment, the door test was popular in some African-American clubs and churches. People in charge of those institutions would paint their doors a certain shade of brown. And if people's skins were darker than the color of the doors, they were not admitted. This is very similar to the brown paper bag test, which was common in Creole Louisiana for many years. But there were black-only beauty contests. They could be found in the black press as early as the 1890s. As the 20th century progressed, these beauty contests were usually sponsored by black newspapers, black cosmetic or hair care companies, the music industry to promote black entertainers, maybe fraternal orders, social clubs, the NAACP, and colleges. In 1891, The Appeal, a black newspaper published in Chicago, launched a beauty contest under the title, Who is the Most Beautiful Afro-American Woman? The Appeal did not try to defend the beauty of African-American women. It took it for granted. But even in contests limited to contestants who self-identified as Negroes, it was obvious that long, straight hair and lighter skin, white standards, were considered the mark of beauty. Pigmentocracy ruled. And then, 1947 contest, Harlem's Golden Gate Ballroom, being hosted by the popular band leader Buddy Johnson. Buddy Johnson's best-known composition you would know. It's the classic Since I Fell for You. He had a lesser hit in 1944 called Fine Brown Frame, which became the title of the beauty contest. Johnson and his panel of judges bypassed Evelyn Sanders, a curvaceous, dark-complexioned woman who was the audience's favorite, and they awarded the title to a light-complexioned woman. Now, this is reported in May 1947 issue of Ebony Magazine. Quote, "The audience would have none of it, however, and articulately let Maestro Johnson and his judging panel know that for once, white standards of beauty would not be forced upon them," end quote. The judges offered to split the prize, and they were met with more shouts and more fist shaking. And soon enough, Miss Evelyn Sanders had been named Miss Fine Brown Frame. Ebony Magazine was founded in 1945 as a black general news magazine. Lots of photos. It was a large format. Think of the old Life or Look or Saturday Evening Post. And it was a monthly. It's still in circulation. Sepia followed in 1946, and it was more of a photojournalism magazine. After these came Jet in 1951 with news, culture, and entertainment. Unlike Ebony, Jet was a weekly magazine in a smaller format. Think of the old TV Guide or Reader's Digest. Then there was Duke, a men's magazine that lasted for six issues in 1957. There were others, Tan, Our World, for example. The only black-oriented publication that predated these was the periodical The Crisis, which has been published by the NAACP since 1910. The importance of skin coloring among blacks persisted well into the 1940s and 1950s. Economist Gunnar Myrdal highlighted the importance of skin color among blacks in his landmark study, An American Dilemma. Researchers found links between skin tone and occupational status, such that light skin tone was highly associated with being a black professional, such as a dentist or doctor or businessman. Attorney Lawrence Otis Graham observed in his expose of black elite social clubs like the Jack and Jill, the Smart Set, the Boulay, that brown paper bag tests and comb tests were regular institutions at balls and cotillions well into the 1970s. Now, "Black is beautiful" became a catchphrase of the 1960s. It may relate to something that James Baldwin wrote in an article for The New Yorker in 1962. He reflected on the time he spent as a younger man, hanging, quote, "with my buddies in those wine and urine-stained hallways," end quote, where he grew up. Thinking about how many of his friends' lives would ultimately be lost to drink or drugs or other trouble, Baldwin had wondered, what will happen to all that beauty? For black people, though I am aware that some of us, black and white, do not know it yet, are very beautiful. Grace Nottage was very beautiful. I talked about her kid sister, civil rights activist C. Dolores Tucker, in a prior episode of Biographical Bites from Bala. If you've heard that, the next couple of minutes may sound familiar, since I'm talking about sisters of the same parents. Grace was born in 1921 to Bahamian immigrant missionaries Reverend Whitfield and his wife Captilda Nottage. Grace was the seventh of 14 children. The Reverend Nottage was born on Tarpon Bay, Eleuthera, in 1883, and he followed his brothers Berlin and Talbert to New York City in 1910, where he took a job running an elevator for $6 a week. Whitfield and Captilda cooked the first meal of their married life over a fire made of newspapers. The growing family moved to Philadelphia in 1925. Reverend Nottage founded a mission, which he operated for many years on South Street, before he established the Ebenezer Community Tabernacle at 19th and Susquehanna Avenue. The Nottages also acquired a 200-acre farm in Upper Salford Township, Montgomery County, where they took in underprivileged black city children and raised tomatoes that they sold to the Campbell Soup Company. All of the children were in church every Sunday, where Captilda played the organ and the saxophone and directed the choir. Captilda Nottage ran a grocery store, an employment agency, and a real estate company. She specialized in helping newly arrived black workers from the South during the Great Migration. And she occasionally had skirmishes with city officials and inspectors for housing and fire code violations. For instance, in a 6 June 1957 article from the Philadelphia Inquirer, she admitted that she'd been cited for violations on 28 properties that she owned from her office at 2205 North 22nd Street. Another of the Nottage sisters, Georgiana Lorraine Nottage Lane, was the first black graduate of the Pennsylvania School of Optometry. She was licensed in 1947. She had a successful practice at 21st and Diamond. Captilda died in 1966. Reverend Whitfield Nottage was 103 years old when he died in 1986. They are buried at Mount Lawn Cemetery. I found very little information about Grace in the newspapers that I have available to me. I got little bits of information here and there. For instance, she was very fashion conscious, and her family nicknamed her Princess Grace. She won, and she spelled it G-R-A-Y-C-E, by the way. She won a Miss Sepia beauty contest in Atlantic City in the 1940s. Now, the contest predates the magazine Sepia by a few years. The two were not related. And in case you're wondering, sepia is a reddish-brown color. It's named after the rich brown pigment derived from the ink sac of the common cuttlefish, sepia. The word sepia is simply the Latinized form of the Greek word cuttlefish. Sepia ink was commonly used for writing in Greco-Roman civilization, and it remained in common use as an artist's drawing material until the 19th century. Sepia was just another shade on the pigmentocracy scale. It was better than black, but it was not up to, quote, high yeller. End quote. In her 1942 Glossary of Harlem Slang, Zora Neale Hurston published a common color scale of the day. It ran, high yaller, yaller, high brown, Vaseline brown, seal brown, low brown, and dark brown. One of the prizes for Miss Sepia was a recording contract, which Grace declined, despite an attractive voice and a childhood surrounded by music. Instead, Grace decided to start her own beauty competition with her sister Ruth. In 1945, they co-sponsored a local Miss Sepia America contest that was won by a 19-year-old junior from Temple University, Dolores Anita Fairfax. Miss Sepia of New Jersey finished second, and Miss Sepia of Chicago was third. And what this newspaper clipping did not explain is there were only three contestants in the pageant. And then there was another article that was published a few weeks later that had the headline, Miss Sepia America Contest Called Fix. The crown holder, Miss Fairfax, was the daughter of a popular Philadelphia big band leader, Frankie Fairfax, who was also leader of the Musicians Union. Even the winner was uncomfortable with the contest results. Although I was naturally thrilled to be chosen Miss Sepia America, I feel that the contest was not a fair one because there wasn't any competition. I think that it affords a wonderful opportunity for the colored girls, and under proper management could go far. There is a public notice in the Philadelphia Inquirer that ran late October 1947 seeking, quote, a certificate for the conduct of business in Philadelphia County, Pennsylvania, under the assumed or fictitious name, style, or designation of Miss Sepia America Beauty Contest, with its principal place of business at 2213 West Berks Street. The names and addresses of all persons owning or interested in said business are Grace Nottage Somerville, 2425 North 19th Street, and Ruth A. Nottage Ross, 2213 West Berks Street. I have no idea where Grace's surname Somerville came from. This is the only time that I saw it associated with her in print. Whether this was an assumed name, whether she was married and took on the name of a husband, I don't know. But this is the only time I saw the name Somerville. Now, in 1951, Grace was 30 years old. There was a brief article in the Miami Times. Mrs. Grace Nottage and her sister Gwendolyn and niece Crystal Ross and brother David Nottage of Philadelphia spent the week here in the city. They were here to attend their uncle's funeral, Mr. William Gardner. While here, and being that Cuba is so near, they decided to spend a week there. End quote. Along the way, Grace earned degrees in elementary and secondary education from Cheney University, and she became an elementary school teacher with the Philadelphia School District. But she wanted more. And when the opportunity arose, she became a member of the Philadelphia Police Department, one of the first black females in the department, and the first to be promoted to detective. On Saturday, 20 October 1951, there was an article in the Inquirer about another of Captilda's brushes with housing inspectors. The article points out that, quote, her daughter Grace was sworn in as a policewoman on Wednesday, end quote. Grace combined her skills in working with children with her police work, and she ended up working as a juvenile probation officer for the Philadelphia courts and as an investigator for the state. She tracked down cigarette runners who failed to pay the sales tax. In January 1954, an article from United Press reported a theft. Quote, policewoman Grace Nicholas reported the theft of her $5,000 silver blue mink coat from her home. Mrs. Nicholas says she was on duty Wednesday when a man went to her home and told her cousin, Grace sent me to get her mink coat. The cousin handed over the coat. In June of 1954, she and fellow police officer Margaret Powers made headlines when they rescued two children, a boy 4 and a 3-month-old, from a Philadelphia apartment where they had been left alone. I find no record of her marriage or where she had acquired the surname Somerville, Then in 1954, there was a box in the newspaper headlined, "Divorce Suits Begun," and the second line reads, "Nicholas Grace C. versus Ronald G." I thought this would give me more information. It was another dead end. I find nothing about Ronald Nicholas in East Coast newspapers. I don't know how long they were married. I don't know when they were married. In 1955, she apparently went undercover to nab a fraud who was passing himself as a medium who would communicate with your dead relatives and tell your fortune for a price. Sidney D. Pickens, who called himself Professor, led a 7-hour session that was attended by Grace. They ended up in a Delaware County graveyard, where hymn-singing followers tossed money into an open grave to rid themselves of their trouble. Pickens was held on $400 bail for the grand jury and charged with fortune-telling. It was illegal. It is still illegal in Pennsylvania. It's a third-degree misdemeanor to tell somebody's fortune for money in the state. Grace kept her sense of flash and fashion no matter what she was doing. For instance, at a time when most automobiles were black, Grace had a special model Buick Roadmaster from Wilkie that had a custom-painted pink top. For a woman who apparently accomplished so much, there is virtually no information about her. In the online sources that I use, there is not a preponderance of black newspapers. I have a feeling that I could find a lot more on her if I had access to the Philadelphia black newspapers. Grace moved to New York City in 1996. I assume it was to be with her daughter, since she was 75 years old by this time. And on 11 September 2001, Grace was in the North Tower building when the first plane hit. She survived the trample of the mad rush from the building, but she had to be hospitalized later due to breathing complications. After exposure to all of that material on September 11th, she developed chronic lung problems, and she died from the effects of COPD on 10 April 2015. She was 93 years old. Grace had chosen her final resting place at Laurel Hill West with care. It's just off the paved road at the top of the Franconia section. It's literally across the street from Billionaire's Row. In fact, if you stand at Grace's stone and you turn around 180 degrees, you're going to be looking at the twin mausoleums of the Dorrance family, the Campbell Soup Dynasty. And I have to wonder if Grace thought about all those tomatoes that she picked as a child that got sent to Campbell's. And then she saw where she was buried, and she smiled to herself and said, I didn't do too badly either. The April 2024 episode of All Bones Considered, Laurel Hill Stories number 61, is for the beginning of the baseball season, Play Ball, Part 3. Francis Richter, who is little remembered today, is truly one of the pioneers of the game and actually has a slot in the Baseball Hall of Fame. John Streicher, who played under the name of Cub Stricker, was a hothead who once climbed into the bleachers to beat up a fan whose needling had gotten to him. Jack McFetridge pitched 2 seasons in the majors, 13 years apart, and he wasn't very good. And Peter Childs played for parts of 2 seasons with the Cardinals, the Phillies, and the Chicago Orphans. In Biographical Bites from Bala, Laurel Hill West Stories, episode number 31, from mid-April, I will talk about 1920s gossip columnist Gladys Hall. She successfully wrote about movie stars over a 40-some-year period. I'm going to tell you about photoplay, modern screen, screenland, and other guides to help you know people who were starring in that great miracle of the day. Motion pictures. I'm not going to read you the upcoming tours. I'll leave it to you to find them. Go to the website, www.laurelhillphl.com/events. All Bones Considered and Biographical Bites from Bala are mostly research, written, narrated, and produced by me, Joe Lex, retired professor of emergency medicine from Temple University, volunteer tour guide, and volunteer podcaster from both cemeteries. You can reach me through my email. In fact, I wish you would, joe@joelex.net. Don't feel like you'd be cluttering up my mailbox. I'd really like to hear from you. The theme song, Names of Peace, is by local artist James Harrow. Hey, maybe I'll see you on a tour. Stay safe, stay well, stay tuned if you want to hear the bibliography. The most helpful work for the bibliography was called Ain't I a Beauty Queen? Black Women, Beauty, and the Politics of Race by Maxine Leeds Craig. Oxford University Press, 2002. Lots and lots of good information in that. As far as the articles, I've got several that are really, really good. Myth America and Other Misses, A Second Look at America Beauty Contests by A.R. Riverall. And the source is ETC, A Review of General Semantics from Summer of 1983, Volume 40, Number 2, pages 207 to 217. Then there's Selling Black Beauty, African-American Modeling Agencies and Charm Schools in Post-War America. Source, Organization of American Historians, Magazine of History, January 2010, Volume 24, Number 10, pages 29 to 32. Black is Beautiful, an American History. The author on that is Stephanie M.H. Kemp. That's from the Journal of Southern History, Volume 81, Number 3, August 2015, pages 675 to 690. And then finally, from the MIT Press, The Unceasing Significance of Colorism. Author on that is Ellis P. Monk, Jr. Daedalus, Spring 2021, Volume 150, Number 2, Immigration, Nativism, and Race in the United States, pages 76 to 90. The most useful newspaper article I found was from the Philadelphia Daily News, 17 April 2015. It's a nice, rather lengthy obituary of Grace. And that's where I got a lot of the personal information about her. I wish there were more out there. I know she did more, but I don't have access to the black newspapers of Philadelphia. And I think I would have a lot more if I went looking for it. Okay. You got some nice weather coming up. Get out to the cemetery. Walk around on your own. Come out. Catch one of the tours that's coming up. You're going to have a lot of fun this summer. Got some good stuff coming up, both on the podcast and at the cemeteries. Maybe I will see you on an upcoming tour. Stay safe, stay well.